Good afternoon. Calling the State Affairs Committee to order at 3:19 p.m. Tuesday, March 14th in the Max Gruenberg Room in the Alaska Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Representative Birch? Representative Johnson? Representative Tuck?
Here.
Representative Josephson? Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wolf? Representative Cobb? Chair Chris Tompkins?
Here. And with four members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Obviously, a little squirrely day in terms of schedule with floor session. I'm glad we could squeeze this in. Major changes to the agenda this week, again, because of floor session. We've winnowed down the agenda, and I should announce now that the evening hearing for State Affairs is canceled because of floor session. We have only two bills on today's agenda, House Bill 82, the third hearing related to off-highway driver's licenses, and it's my intent and hope to take action on that bill today. And then also the second hearing for House Bill 74, the Driver's License ID Cards and Real ID Act. There will be no committee action but invited testimony and questions today. Thank you, Martha, Ben, and Stephanie, for keeping us going. And at this time, moving the first item on the agenda, House Bill 82. And for today, we've got one amendment that was submitted, as well as public testimony and then committee discussion and motion. Is there a motion for amendment number one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move amendment number one, version 30-LS0367/D1.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. Ms. Wilbur, I know you've been working with DMV on this amendment. Would you be willing to come up, put yourself on the record, and speak to amendment number one?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Barrett Wilbur, staff to Rep. Chris Tompkins. I'm happy to speak to amendment number one. This amendment was drafted as a result of a conversation with the Division of Motor Vehicles. After last week's committee hearing, they had a meeting, came up with some a few small changes they'd like to see to the bill to clarify the intent. So I will go through and talk about what that means. For amendment, for the first section, deleting to the land connected state highway system and do not have land connected road access. This is just cleaning up the language and ensuring that ferry accessible communities are eligible for off-highway driver's licenses if they do not have DMVs. While the ferry, state ferry, may count as a state highway, it is not a road. So this small change in language clarifies that ferry communities are eligible. That second, page 2, line 23, substituting 12 months for fiscal year, the department felt it was more appropriate to use 12 months rather than the fiscal year because 12 months guarantees that you have a road test offered at least once every 12 months instead of, for instance, the fiscal year, you could end up with a situation where you wouldn't have road tests offered for 22 months. That last page 4, line 8 change is just inserting the word non-commercial before the word vehicle, and it's a conforming change to match the other another section of the bill so that both sections read non-commercial vehicles to make it absolutely clear that we are not affecting anything to do with commercial vehicles or licensure in this bill. And so thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilbur. Before any questions from the committee, I see Amy Johnson and Audrey O'Brien from DMV online and want to ask you, Ms. Johnson or Ms. O'Brien, if you have any comments to add to Amendment D.1. Or maybe I will specifically direct that to you, Ms. Johnson, the Deputy Director, if you have any further comments on this amendment.
Good afternoon. This is Amy Johnson, Deputy Director for the DMV. I do not have it. Mr. Chair, I do not have anything else to add on that.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee on Amendment A dot or D dot one? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure the question's for Ms. Wilbur or for you, and it's not in regards to the amendment, it's in regards to a point on the talking points here. Would you like me to ask the question in regards to that?
Sure, please go ahead.
In that second talking point, make sure road tests have to be offered every 12 months rather than the fiscal year, which could mean 22 months without testing. Can you explain that to me, please?
Yes, Representative Knopp, through the chair. The way the fiscal year is structured, if you had a road test offered at the very beginning of one fiscal year, and then one road test offered at the very end of the next fiscal year, you could potentially go more than 12 months without offering a road test, even though you would still be offering a road test in each of those fiscal years.
Follow-up?
So I guess I'm curious why we didn't just make the length of the licenses the same period as for a non-road license, since the whole issue is about accessing to DMVs. Why did we just not make it consistent with what we do for on-road licenses?
And I wonder, maybe Ms. Johnson, if you have any perspective on Representative Knopp's question.
Yes, this is Amy Johnson with the DMV. Through the chair, can we hear that question one more time, please?
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Representative Knopp here through the chair. One of the talking points on this, on the amendment, was clarifying that you could go longer, clarifying the fiscal year, so it means you could go 22 months without the road skills test. And so I'm wondering, less than 2 years is half the time of the road skills test for an on-road licenses. And since the issue is access to DMVs, I'm wondering why we don't stay consistent and make that time frame the same as the on-road licenses.
Ms. Johnson, any response to Representative Knopf's question?
Yes, this is Amy Johnson with the DMV through the chair, Representative. That 12-month time frame is actually just to allow us the opportunity to get out there to do the road test so that they don't end up with an off-highway license.
Follow-up, or Ms. Wilbur, do you have a comment?
I do, yes, Representative Knopp, through the chair. I think I can clarify. That 12-month period is not how long the off-highway driver's license is eligible or valid. That 12-month period refers to the amount of time that a community can go without having a DMV or having road tests offered before it becomes eligible to get off-highway licenses. So, for instance, if the DMV closed in Kotzebue, the department would have 12 months to either fly someone out to offer road tests in that community or reopen the DMV or make it eligible for off-highway licenses.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Any further questions on Amendment D.1? Seeing none, I'm going to withdraw my objection. Is there any further objection to the adoption of Amendment D.1? Seeing none and hearing none, Amendment D.1 passes. That brings us back to the bill before us as amended. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony, and we have several people online and several people in the room, I believe, to testify. I shall also note that Representative Wohl joined us at 3:22 p.m. Public testimony is open, and going to go to the those online first. We have Heather Powell in Hoonah. Heather, would you identify yourself, state any affiliation, and please present your testimony?
Also, I'm going to switch to Kachuhan, aka Hoonah Powell. I'm going to choose train. My name is Heather Powell. I am a resident of Hoonah. I'm also an educator for grades preschool through 12th grade. I received some information about House Facility 2, and I have met with my high school students here in Hoonah with a lot of information that I wanted to share with the committee.
so I thank you for the opportunity to do that. I'd like to call and strongly support off-road licenses for our rural community. I think that it's very, very important that our rural communities should be known and our voices should be heard. In our community, we have many, many miles of logging roads and roads that are both state and federal. And in our communities, these roads, they lead us to the places where we fish and where we subsist. Majority of our community also relies upon wood heat. So these are places where we can go out and hunt and gather and to really live our traditional life. We are in such a rural community that our community and our, not only our students and our families, but we rely upon each other. Our community is a huge family. So we're working together to be able to gain access to these places and to be safe while we're doing it. We need to be able to support our youth and let them feel comfortable as they work towards the ability to become regularly licensed. The costs that are associated with us being off of the road system and living in a rural area, the costs that are associated are far more than any of those that they would incur for those people that are on road systems or that have Division of Motor Vehicle offices available to them. We're looking at the cost of ferry tickets, the cost of housing, vehicle costs, there and back, round trips. Sometimes our ferry system is just not, it doesn't accommodate our needs in rural communities as much as we'd like it to. So our rural communities really should have the support as well as the ability to provide off-road licensing to our residents, because I think that it's important that we do ensure that safety is our number one concern. We need to be very, very clear that we want our community members to be safe while they're doing it. So making sure that people are getting their off-road licenses rather than just not having licensing at all, and being able to make sure that they have the ability to function within their communities, not only in a safe manner, but really in a realistically in a manner that's going to allow them to live the life that this land provides. I think that if we're able to give them these tools, that if they're able to receive their off-road licensing from the communities for which they live, that it's going to make them successful. And I strongly, strongly support that. There are many reasons why we need to uphold our rural communities, but one of them is absolutely safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Powell, for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee for Ms. Powell? Thank you, Ms. Powell. And next online is Marla Howard from CAKE. Ms. Howard, if you can identify yourself for the record, state any affiliation, and please present your testimony.
Hi, sure. My name is Marla Howard. I am Councilwoman from CAKE, and I'm calling to testify for HB 82. Yes, we do want this, and yes, it will be used. I do know of persons who must and did travel for their driver's licenses, and for those who can't afford to go and get them, they drive anyway. We really don't have proper law and protection, proper law and order here, but we do the best we can. Anyway, as for travel and ever-rising prices and the threatening of our ferry system, yeah, this would be a huge but small gesture to help our poor economy-stricken villages. We do pay the highest rates for fuel, food, and electricity. So yes, please vote for this. And hi, Barrett. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Howard, for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Howard. And this takes us to testimony in the room. I see one person signed in, Ken Scaffelstead. If you'd come forward, put yourself on the record, state any affiliation, and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kenny Scaffelstead. I'm the mayor of the city of Hoonah. I'm here today to catch the ear of this committee and the legislature in general and urge them to pass the provisions in House Bill 82. I've had a chance to read the recent revisions and the amendments, and I think that it's the bill itself makes good sense for those communities affected by what I consider idiosyncrasy of past legislation. I think it speaks that the passage of this bill would speak to your rural communities, that this legislature is willing to consider that them small ponds feel every little raindrop that hit them. And in a way, this bill speaks that our legislature can make some sense out of things. It's a very commonsensical approach and to easing the way for those of us that were kind of caught in a strange corner. It makes sense. It'll work. Well, we'll make it work. And I support House Bill 82. I urge you to move it forward and get it passed into law. And I thank you very much for letting me be here for you.
Thank you, Mr. Scafstead. Any questions from the committee? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, thank you for coming in to testify. I'm just trying to get a feel for the bill, and every community is different, I understand, so I'll only ask you about your community. I'm just trying to get a feel for it. We've had various testimony, and over the course of the testimony, I feel like I understand a little some more of the issues a little better. Do you feel like this, that in your community, for example, do most of the people have full driver's licenses, and this affects a smaller minority of people that for one reason or another find it more difficult to come into, say, Juneau or somewhere where there's a DMV?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, I think this affects a significant number of people. To answer the first part of your question, most of our residences do have driver's licenses. Those that perchance do not suffer a delay in the time and the opportunity financially, logistically. It's going to have to fit with a whole other things in life for them to make the trip to arrange what it takes to officiate to officially receive a driver's license. That little delay goes back to my analogy about when one raindrop hitting that little pond makes a big ripple. At times in reference to commercial applications, that portion of the bill, it's consequential to not have an able-bodied driver not legally able to contribute to the economic opportunity at hand. It is a great builder for our young folks who come of age and are eligible under this bill to be able to drive legally in the off-road setting as they acquaint themselves with driving in general. We try to do a good job at enforcing traffic laws and keeping in line with those things so they drive responsibly. When that youngster has to wait perhaps months or years to get to where he's actually going to get a driver's license to be capable, that's just a big, huge gaping hole in the opportunity there. And again, I'd like to reiterate that there are advantages on the commercial side of this to the community that I don't think present a wide hazard or deficit to the rest of the state.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Scafflestead? Thank you, Mr. Scafflestead, for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room to testify on House Bill 82? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and that takes us back to the bill as amended. Is there any committee discussion or comment before a motion?
Brief at ease, Mr. Chair.
Brief at ease. In fact, we do have a comment question. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to see if Department of Motor Vehicles wanted to comment on the current attached fiscal note, because it seems like to me something like this should be a pretty easy fix, since this is something that DMV had been doing in the past already. So if they don't mind just walking us through why there was $66,200 fiscal note attached to this.
And Ms. Johnson, if you feel best suited to take that, please put yourself on the record and present any thoughts.
This is Amy Johnson, Deputy Director with the DMV. I actually do not have that in front of me right now, so I do not feel like I can really speak to that at this moment.
And I also know Audrey O'Brien is online. Ms. O'Brien, perhaps I should have directed that your way.
This is Audrey O'Brien with the Division of Motor Vehicles in Juneau. Unfortunately, no, I don't have access to that fiscal note to be able to comment on it.
And
okay. May I just ask another question?
Sure, please.
I mean, Mr. Chair, this is Representative Tuck. So it just seems to me that because this was regular operations for so long, when you began requiring people to get their driver's licenses in these communities, did that increase your budget, or did that reduce your budget in any way? Because to have a positive fiscal note here, I would think that there must have been savings at one time, if they implemented something. And it must have cost them savings, because if they're going back to what they once did, then it really should be a zero fiscal note. Or, unless there was some cost savings, and for some reason it cost more to do this.
And I maybe can jump in here. I had a conversation with a DMV director on Friday morning, I believe, and it's my understanding that there's very likely to be a revision to the fiscal note that will zero it out. But I realize that Ms. Johnson and Ms. O'Brien weren't party to that conversation. Although I should note, if there's anyone in the room who would like to speak to that, you're invited to. But otherwise, Ms. Johnson or Ms. O'Brien, do you have any comment you'd like to offer?
Actually, this is Amy Johnson, Deputy Director with the DMV. Mr. Chair, I just did check in with Marla Thompson and found out that it should be a zero fiscal note. We just have not had time to get that updated yet.
Okay, that clarifies everything. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. That was very quick. Any further committee comment on the bill prior to a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move committee substitute for House Bill 82, version 30-LS0367/D, as amended, out of committee with individual recommendations and with a forthcoming zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 82 moves from committee as amended with attached forthcoming zero fiscal note. And that will take us to the next item on today's agenda, House Bill 74. This is the second hearing for House Bill 74. There will be no committee action today, but invited testimony, and I understand Deputy Commissioner Rydell will be here soon. She's coming from another committee, but I'm going to go right over to invited testimony, and we have a number of people who have signed up for, we've been in contact with about testifying, and going to start with Aves Thompson with Alaska Trucking Associations. Mr. Thompson, if you can put yourself on the record and present any thoughts on Real ID that the committee should know about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Aves Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. The Alaska Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing the interests of our nearly 200 member companies from Barrow to Ketchikan. Freight movement is an essential element of our economy and impacts all of us each and every day. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 74. The House Bill 74, the Real ID Act, and its companion bill in the other body provides for a compliant Real ID driver's license in addition to Alaska's current non-compliant federal Real ID driver's license. And I note that these changes also will impact the commercial driver's license. excuse me. DMV's webpage shows a total of nearly 33,000 Alaska CDL holders, and there are thousands of commercial vehicle drivers who are not required to hold CDL because of the weight of their trucks. Many commercial vehicle drivers, both CDL and non-CDL, have need to enter military installations in the course of their daily deliveries. These deliveries include things like food, fuel, consumer goods, and military materiel, and all things necessary to supply a small city while providing for the national defense. Many commercial driver's license holders, let me back up a step there. In the Anchorage area, many commercial vehicle drivers have what's known as a TWIC card, a Transportation Workers Identification Card, that is a requirement for unescorted access into the Port of Anchorage. And that's a Coast Guard / TSA / Homeland Security requirement. And so that would serve as a real, as a form of real ID under the Real ID Act. But as you can see from the numbers of the number of drivers, CDL holders in the state, the impact of a non-compliant CDL or other driver's license would be considerable. Military installations are governed by federal rules, and after June 6th of 2017, will no longer accept an Alaska-issued driver's license or CDL license as a form of acceptable identification. Drivers will need to obtain a federally recognized form of identification in order to gain access to military installations. Those forms of federal ID may be, as I said, a TWIC card, maybe a passport, might be your military retiree card, military identification card, but of course not all truck drivers are military retirees. And this, what this will mean is that each of the drivers in Alaska that don't have a TWIC card are going to have to get some other form of identification. A TWIC card, for example, costs in excess of $100 per license. If you were to hire a driver today and say that, tell him or her that they need a TWIC card, it would be anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks before you could put that person on your payroll because it takes that long for the TWIC card to be issued. Same is true with passports. Passports take a long time to get issued, and they also cost money. In terms of how this impacts drivers in Alaska, in Anchorage, as I say, the TWIC card holders will not be impacted. But there are a lot of non-TWIC card holders, drivers in Anchorage. In Fairbanks and the interior, it's a different story. Those drivers typically don't go in and out of the Port of Anchorage, but they do have a need to go on to the military installations, as I pointed out earlier. So I guess what the point I'd like to stress here is that this is a big deal for us. And we can understand that there are concerns about privacy issues and people not wanting to have another type of federal ID in terms of a federal real ID compliant driver's license. But at the same time, I believe that DMV has presented an option here that says you may have either a compliant real ID driver's license or a non-compliant real ID driver's license. So if you choose not to undergo apply for that CDL that's real ID compliant, you don't have to. So I guess our point is that if you can give us all the option, then we can deal with it. June 6, 2017 seems like a long ways away, but it's just a matter of a few months. And then what do we do? We've had extension after extension, and Homeland Security finally has said no. We're not going to do it anymore, so we urge you to take swift action on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. There's a question from the committee. Representative Ledoux.
So, Mr. Thompson, if this is such a big deal, and I understand it is, in order to get on base, in order to get on airplanes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and folks know that this deadline is coming up in just a couple of months, and this bill hasn't passed, I mean, and since people know that there's a deadline, why can't people just get these, did you say, trick cards, or if they're not eligible for trick cards, for the passport card, which my understanding is only costs about $50 and is good for about 10 years.
The trick cards, my understanding, somewhere north of $100. The last time I bought my passport, it was $50, or renewed my passport, it was $50. I don't know what it is today, but there's a lot of time involved there, and in some cases, $50 is a lot of money to some of our drivers. So I guess we could all go out and get them, but then what would happen if you decide to pass the law? We're just kind of waiting to see. If, in fact, you choose not to pass it, then we'll all be scrambling to get some form of federal ID. And we're not sure since there is an option, we're not sure that it's fair to the 30 to 40,000 truck drivers to have to go out and get another ID, another federally approved ID in terms of a trick card or a passport.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux?
No, I'll wait to comments, the section on comments.
And Representative Knopp and then Representative Wall.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson, through the chair, Representative Knopp here. I think early on in this process you submitted a letter, and I think in that letter, if I recall, and you may correct me if I get this wrong, but I thought there was some components of this particular bill you did not support at that time. Do I have that right, or?
No, sir. I don't believe we opposed it.
Okay. I thought I saw a letter from ATA that said there was you had concerns about portions of the bill, but I'll research that. I may be thinking of somebody else. So, but you did. I did hear you say through the chair follow up. I did hear you say, Mr. Thompson, that the TWIC cards were acceptable forms of ID for getting onto these bases. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, yes.
And I also know that the TSA security, the travel brochures, the certificates that you issue through them would also be authorized for access. Is that your understanding as well?
Through the chair, I'm sorry. Could you repeat that, sir?
Through the chair, TSA, Transportation Security Administration, also issues for airport travel. You can get them at the airport. They cost you $50, I think. It's a pre-security type deal. They issue one for travel. I think they are also, have you heard, that they also authorized for access to these military facilities? Do you know that?
It's my understanding that the TSA pre-check and the global entry programs are both acceptable forms of federal ID.
Okay.
But there again, there are fees involved with that, anywhere from $80 to $100.
Okay. Yeah, and that was my understanding as well. So I'm going to get to commercial truck drivers here in just a minute. So I think it's 10,000 GVW and under does not require commercial license. Is that your understanding?
26,000. Less than 26 through the chair.
Because I know my little F-450 flatbed truck, Mr. Thompson, is a with a snow plow and a sanding box, doesn't weigh that much, and my guys are required to have a CDL to drive that, according to DMV, so I'm about 12,000 pounds there.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, yes, I misspoke. I was thinking of the Class A CDL is 26,000 or more, but there's a Class B and a Class C that reach down into the lower levels, such as you've just described.
That's correct. So in my mail last 2 weeks ago, Mr. Thompson, through the chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Thompson, I got my notice from DMV. I have it here in front of me that states that the new federal law now demands that for CDL drivers you have to provide a proof of citizenship, and then they list out the passport, birth certificate. So that sounds to me like for CDL drivers, that's already going to have to happen, whether you're Class A, B, or C, regardless if this law passes or not. Or either that or the DMV is issued this prematurely before this law passes. And so do you happen to know anything about that?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, my memory's fuzzy on that one.
Okay.
I'd have to check that one out, please.
Okay. Well, it's new to me, Mr. Thompson. I just received it in the mail, and I thought that's interesting. I have this in front of me, and now I'm told I have to do this anyway. So I just didn't know if you'd heard.
And Representative Knopp, we have Marla Thompson, the DMV director, online. And Ms. Thompson, if you heard Representative Knopf's last question, would you be able to speak to what he was asking about?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Knopf, recently the federal government has mandated that CDLs have to show proof of the citizenship of where they're going to be living. So it's part of the rules now, but it doesn't make you real ID compliant.
Follow up?
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm kind of curious how it does not. I mean, it's the same requirements for the CDL as it does for the real ID compliant as far as documentation of citizenship. I'm kind of wondering how it doesn't make you compliant.
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, the only difference is that we are not a real ID compliant state. So you are absolutely correct. It's the same documents that will be needed. So it will be very quick and easy for the CDL holder.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just to clarify one of the points that Representative Knopf brought up, and I don't know if you have someone from the Department of Administration on, because they do and should know it better than I do. But from my understanding, it's not so much what ID is required of you, because right now to get a driver's license, perhaps you might have to show a birth certificate and or a passport, depending on what else you bring to the DMV. The real ID aspect is the verification of those documents. Instead of somebody just looking at it and go, oh, that looks pretty good, we'll give you a license, they actually have to run it, you know, coordinate with another verification entity. And that's what separates the real ID from the non-real ID, as I'm told. So it's more of the verification of the documents, the passport, the birth certificate, what have you, that makes one ID more real than the other. Maybe someone from DOA is around that can.
And Minta Montalbo, do you feel comfortable speaking to the topic at hand?
Before we get to that person, Mr. Chair, can we finish with our testifier?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe would you be able to sort of confirm,
since
Representative?
Your question wasn't towards.
Correct. I was just trying to help.
Do you want me to sit here or wait?
If you wouldn't mind, maybe just sort of confirm Representative Wolf's thinking, we can return to Mr. Thompson and conclude committee questions.
Certainly. For the record, my name is Minta Montalbo. I'm the legislative liaison for Department of Administration. And my understanding of Representative Wolf's description is correct, that whether or not you have to show documentation for a CDL license, that is a federal requirement, but that's separate from real ID. And unless Alaska becomes a real ID compliant state, TSA will not accept a CDL license. Even though you've provided the same proof, TSA will not accept it as a real ID compliant identification.
Thank you. And maybe before we go full on into DOA, conclude any questions for Mr. Thompson. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thompson, so we know that Homeland Security, this Real ID Act federally, has been coming on for 8 years. Have you guys done anything at the federal level to try to reverse this act, which was highly debated?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, there have been some efforts over the years to minimize the impact of it. I'm not sure that there was an organized effort to try to repeal it. but I know there were some objections from some of the states, as is evidenced by those, 25 or 26 states that do not have real ID compliant licenses.
And if I may, Mr. Chair. Yeah, because I agree with your statement earlier saying that this is unfair, and I think this is unfair what they're imposing, not only on drivers and workers, but on Alaskans and Americans. And so I just kind of trying to see if there's any type of coordinated effort at the federal level, rather than trying to put pressure on us at the state level, what kind of efforts have been taking place there. So I'll probably, if you don't mind, Mr. Thompson, give you a call at some time and just see what kind of efforts that we can join together in trying to make it fair for Americans everywhere to be able to have access and be able to travel.
Well, through the chair, Representative Tuck, we've kind of taken the position that we fought the good fight and we lost, and so we just kind of have to roll over and do this one.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Representative Tuck.
So does that mean that you're not willing to go any further at the federal level?
Well, through the chair, Representative Tuck, yes, we are. But we're at a point now where there's a June 6th deadline of 2017, and if the Alaska legislature fails to act, why, we're kind of in a bind.
Okay. Yes, thank you. And I just want to make sure it's clear that it's not Alaska putting you in the bind, it's the federal government putting you in the bind. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions for Mr. Thompson? Thank you, Mr. Thompson, for your testimony. Next we have in the room Brian Duffy from the Department of Military Veterans and Veterans Affairs. Mr. Duffy, if you could come forward, put yourself on the record, note your affiliation, and present any thoughts on House Bill 74.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Duffy. I currently serve as the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Relatively new to the team, came on board on 1 December. And by way of background, before this, 27 years active duty with the U.S. Air Force, last assignment as the Chief of Staff, Air Force's Central Command, LUD Air Base Cutter. Among other things, helping our Combined Forces Air Component Commander direct the efforts of a 2,400-person, 20-nation coalition staff executing air operations in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, across the Arabian Gulf, and with our partners in Yemen. I had the privilege, while on active duty, having retired again as a colonel in October, back in 2012 to 2014, serving as the commander of Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson and the 673rd Air Base Wing up in Anchorage. So I thanks for your opportunity to, or for the opportunity to come share a few thoughts on the potential impacts associated with this legislation. It's important for the committee members to understand that federal installations such as Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson are complying with provisions of the Real ID Act now. Visitors who wish to obtain unescorted access and do not have DOD identification cards or others which are compliant with Real ID Act are being denied entry or being required to be escorted by a DOD ID card holder while on the installation. This includes individuals with driver's license from Maine, Missouri, and Montana, or those with non-enhanced licenses from Minnesota or Washington. If there's no change in statute by Alaska's extension expiration date of 6 June 2017, Alaska driver's licenses and similar identification cards from six additional states, assuming no change from them as well, will simply be added to the listing of identification cards designated as insufficient, much like Maine and Montana were added at the end of January 2017. The installations have no waiver authority, and there should be no expectation they would pursue any. Not all who need access to our installations have DOD ID cards. In the case of Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, there are some 50 mission partners across the base, some federal, some state, and some combination or of public and private organizations. In speaking with leaders at the base now, they estimate approximately 14,000 contractors and local service providers may be affected and required to have alternative forms of identification, as we've discussed earlier, or they'll be unable to access the installation. And it would be highly unreasonable to assume the installation would provide escort for all these visitors. So in terms of other organizations that are affected, we heard from Mr. Thompson earlier on one aspect. I'd like to understand things like the folks that move military families onto and off of the installation, their employees are a large part of the workforce that participate. On Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, all 3,262 military family housing units are privatized or, in essence, operated and owned by a private organization, which is a workforce that's required to move on to the installation and then move on. And in addition, more personally, the state of Alaska's Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is headquartered on the Richardson side, if you will, of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, a 260-person or so organization. And currently, the folks that are in those kinds of categories are often issued from the base what's called a DBIDS card, Defense Biometrics Identification System, and that allows them to have unescorted access. Well, in order to get that card, they have to produce a Real ID compliant form of identification to be run through the system to be checked so they can be issued that DBIDS card. What we anticipate happening is those cards will be allowed to expire at their normal period. They won't all go dead on the 6th of June, but at what their normal expiration date is, again, if no change in the current position we have now, all of those folks that have been issued those cards and wish to retain unescorted access to the installation and in many cases be able to report to work will have to get another form of ID sufficient to then be issued that DBIDS card. We also have, Mr. Chairman, I believe on the line, our Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Bob Dole, and so I defer for a moment in case Mr. Dole has any other points you'd like to offer, and then I'd certainly be happy to answer your questions or any of those from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. And it doesn't look like Mr. Dole's been able to join online, although if that changes, I'll let you know. Any further comments?
No, sir. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Ledoux.
I'm not sure you're the right person to be asking this, but I'll try anyway. So it seems like if you don't get this real ID card that the consequences as far as getting admitted to military bases are fairly draconian. But there also seems to be a bunch of states that are not real ID compliant. So what's happened there? I mean, assumedly Western civilization hasn't crumbled.
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, thank you for your question. So as I understand it, 24 states, territories, and the District of Columbia have moved on and moved on with the elements of the Real ID Act. And for those states that have not, their driver's license is insufficient to allow access, unescorted access to military installations. And I'll give you an example. Joint Base Lewis-McChord, down just north of or south of Spokane, Washington, issues some 220,000 passes per year. If there's a person that comes up with all they have is the ID from a non-real ID compliant state, that's all they have, they're not allowed unescorted access. They must have a sponsor to bring them on the base or they're turned away. That's exactly what's happening.
So what do people, contractors and so forth, what have they done in those states?
I don't think I'm qualified to answer that question through the chair, Representative Ledoux.
Representative Knopp.
So it's kind of interesting because you almost get to a scenario where you have a standoff. So if this legislative body does not approve this bill and we adopt the Real ID Act, I would think that you guys, your facilities, not you guys, your facilities would be looking for a way to work with your suppliers, because it's not only the guys not get to work, but they also can't deliver supplies or services that the facilities may need. So I would think that we'd be looking at Plan B here, be honest with you. So I think it's damaging on both ends.
So through the chair, Representative Knopp, thank you for your point. I'll just offer for the record, they're not state facilities, they're federal facilities. So the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has limited opportunity to adjust that federal posture. We're simply going to comply like others. And so our employees, will have a conversation with them on what they'll need to do to be able to get to work.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Minnesota just blocked the Real ID bill on Monday, March 6th, just recently. And so I guess my first question through the chair is, does Minnesota have any military bases in their state?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I don't believe they have any active installations. There may be a Guard or Reserve installation here or there, and I can't speak to exactly where they are. I will offer for the record, though, through the chair, that both Washington and Minnesota have an enhanced version of a driver's license as an option, which is compliant with the Real ID provision, which allows then people to use those for unescorted access to federal installations.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So they are in compliance with the Real ID Act?
Through the chair, Representative, I won't speak on behalf of those states, but my understanding is they offer an enhanced version of driver's license, which is compliant.
Okay.
So whether you want to call that compliant or not, or halfway, I'd leave to your judgment.
Okay, and if I may, Mr. Chair, I just want to bring it to the committee's attention that on March 6th of 2017, earlier this month, that the final vote to pass Real ID was 29-38. So I don't know what form their bill was, but they did reject some sort of measure of Real ID, in which it says that that now they're going to have to either become Real ID compliant with some other form to be able to go on the federal facilities, such as the airport. And so it says here that if Minnesota does not change its licenses, state residents will have to bring additional identification, like a passport or state-issued enhanced driver's license. So they must have that. And my next question is, if I may, Mr. Chair, so the Department of Defense does allow cards to be issued, and I think you call it a DBIDS card, is that correct?
DBIDS card, through the chair, Representative Tuck, Defense Biometrics Identification System. Those that have recurring need to access the installation, rather than have to run their credentials every time they access, it's easier to issue them a card that's good for a year. And that's what many of our state of Alaska employees have that don't have another DOD ID card.
If I may, Mr. Chair, so to get one of those Defense Biometrics ID cards, then would a passport be acceptable as a compliant ID card to get a DBIDS ID?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I believe the answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Knopp.
And it may not be the question for you, but so it's interesting when Representative Wool mentioned it's about the verification of that ID. So I'm kind of curious if a guy can just show up his passport at the facility and get on, but it hasn't been verified. We're still not in compliance with the Real ID law. Understand where I'm going with that? Representative Wool earlier was saying that it's not so much in the passport, it's a verification that it's authentic, or the birth certificate, or whatever you may be using. Did I understand that correctly?
Is that a question for me?
I think through the chair, I'm going to pose that one to Representative Wool, yes.
Suddenly I'm an expert on Real ID. My understanding is to get a Real ID, and you go to the DMV and you bring a passport or a birth certificate or something like that, in the past they might have taken it at face value. Now they go through verification process, which connects with some of these entities that were given in that flow chart a couple weeks ago. As far as getting on an airplane or to a federal facility, I would imagine if you pull up the passport and show it to whoever, they just say okay. They don't verify it through a database or verification through another system. They just take it at face value. So it's not a real ID. It's not a real ID, quote unquote. It's a passport, which suffices for federal facilities. But again, I'm not the Department of Administration expert.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it used to be, before we started sending off our IDs to Indiana, that there would be supporting documentation, and a photo would be taken, and that documentation used to be shipped up to Fairbanks and used to be held in the troopers' barracks. And then those files were kept pretty secure, but it was not electronic data, if you will. Somebody would have to physically go in there and look at the file just to verify anything from there on. But what my understanding of Real ID is that it does go to a database now. And there's this hub that all states are going to have to be connected to. And then all that data is going to be centralized to some sort of security industrial complex organization that's a private organization. And so... That's the verification, and then those documents are going to be stored. Whether you get an ID or not, those documents can be stored up to 5 years. And even if you don't get an ID, even if you don't qualify an ID, they're keeping those images, and there has to be some sort of image document that goes along with that. And I think that's where some of the security measures comes into place, and some of the problems with having private entities having access to all this information in one central spot.
And I know Representative Ledoux has questions for Mr. Duffy, but on this thread of questions, Mr. Duffy or Director Thompson online, or Ms. Montalbo, if you have any comments to as to the last three committee comments.
So, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Brian Duffy, I'd certainly be glad to take Representative Knopf's question back to Jaber and speak with base officials on the process they use to take some form of compliant identification and translate it into a DBIDS card. I think we owe that back to you.
Representative Knopf.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Duffy, thank you for that. But I am curious because as you indicated, you may be able to show a passport and get access. And Mr. Wool earlier had said that he thought it wasn't so much a passport, but the verification of that it was authentic, you know. So I just kind of curious, you know, because if the goal is to be compliant with the Real ID Act, that would not, as we related it to commercial driver's licenses. So that's why. Thank you.
And I've just been informed Deputy Commissioner Dole has joined. So Deputy Commissioner Dole, if you have any thoughts on this question that Representative Knopf posed, please do offer them.
Through the chair, my apologies for getting in late. I had some telephone difficulties. I have been listening to the discussion online, and I think Colonel Duffy or Director Duffy has well answered the questions on behalf of the DMVA. I have nothing to add. Thank you.
Thank you. Before Representative Ledoux's questions, I wanted to ask Director Thompson also. I know Representative Wool was kind of standing in as a Real ID expert there for a second, and Director Thompson, if you had any thoughts as to the question Representative Knopf posed, Representative Wool.
Yes, this is Marla Thompson, Director of the DMV. Just a comment on the storage of the records. I want to just make sure that we understand there is today we look at people's documents and we don't take it at face value. Well, we take it at face value. In the future, we would need to really look at each document and make sure that it is a compliant document. The storage of the records is required, but we also have regulations right now that require us to store records as well. So that's not something that we don't already do. Hopefully that's helpful.
Maybe.
I didn't hear the last part of what she said.
Would you be able to repeat the last one or two sentences, Ms. Thompson?
Yes, Representative, I'm sorry, I was having a hard time with hearing who it was talking with.
That's okay. The audio quality went south there for the last couple sentences. If you wouldn't mind just restating the end of your comments there.
So I just wanted to clear up and make sure that today we do keep records and we store records, and jumping to the Real ID records, it's going to be very similar. We have, we store these records at the DMV through, this is not going outside. We don't share the records. We share as little as we can. But we do keep the storage of documents here. And we are regulated. We keep them currently for 7 years.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Ms. Thompson.
Yes,
Thompson. Okay. I want to say Marlo Thomas, but that's someone else. And also for Mr. Duffy. But I'll go with Ms. Thompson first. So currently the DMV stores documents, scans someone's documentation that they bring in, stores it in a server or something, I imagine, locally, and this isn't shared with any outside entity. And in the future with Real ID, to the extent that you can, that will be the same process, or is there a central database in Fort Knox or something like that?
So through the chair, Representative Wolf, that is absolutely correct. We keep the data here in local servers. We do not share the data outside. And that will be the same with Real ID.
Okay, thank you.
And I know Representative.
I don't know when
you had a question.
Switch over to the
for
you tell
Mr.
Me
Duffy.
Yeah.
Representative Ledoux.
Either Mr. Duffy or Bob Dole. So I'm wondering if there are any states that have refused to implement a Real ID Act, which have military bases, and if so, how have the military bases dealt with this? Because this is not something that would only be inconvenient for the people who are trying to get on the military bases. This would be something that it would be inconvenient for you military folks, I would think. So how have you dealt with that?
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'd offer as an example, Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, is a federal installation in a non-compliant state. And in terms of what the installation would do to deal with this is they would simply refuse access, unescorted access, to anybody that didn't have a Real ID compliant form of identification. That's exactly what they're doing.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, what have you done to reach out to people to get them on the military base? Because people don't only it's not only people that need to be on the military base, but you need people on the military base too. So if some vendor that you had hired gets to the gate and doesn't have a Real ID, or calls you and says, hey, you know, I need to come over here and deliver X, Y, and Z, but I don't have a Real ID, what have you told these guys? How is it being dealt with, other than you're just telling me that you can't let anybody on base? There's got to be a plan B for everybody.
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, while I won't speak on behalf of the command element at Fort Leonard Wood, I would offer from my experience, one of two things would likely happen. One, the individual requesting unescorted access would be turned away. Or two, some form of escort would be found, which I would estimate would not be a sustainable, you know, sustainable issue for the long term. Or perhaps if there's a third option is, eventually the individual desiring unescorted access gets a form of Real ID compliant ID. Those are the three things that could happen.
And follow up. And can they get that form of Real ID compliant ID from the military itself?
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in the case of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richards, and as I described earlier, that DBIDS card is obtainable, but must first in advance have a Real ID compliant form of ID to have the credentials of the individual vouched before they're issued that.
Just follow up. So is there any way that somebody who is not in a Real ID compliant state and does not have a passport can get this kind of card?
I'd have to take that again for the record through the chair, Representative. I'd have to take that back for the record. My anticipation is no. But I could take that for the record as well and discuss further with JBRA officials.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wohl, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to go over some of the dates you mentioned because I was unclear. I'm from Fairbanks. We have a couple military facilities up there, and I have friends that are non-military but work on them. And for a while, they were calling me. And I guess there's an extension of the waiver period. I'm maybe you can help clarify. I thought right now we weren't for federal facilities. There was a waiver, and maybe this person has a DBIS card, and I'm not aware of that. But I was under the impression that the waiver had been extended till June. Well, can you fill me in on the dates right now? So if I try to get on, say, Fort Wainwright, and I pull up to the gate with my driver's license and registration and try to get a day pass to go to the bowling alley or something like that, will I be able to do that, or will I need to be escorted?
So, Representative Wohl, through the chair, the answer is today, yes, you'll be just fine with your normal Alaska driver's license and whatever normal process Eielson or Fort Wainwright uses, my understanding, again, not being in the command chain anymore, right. That you'll be just fine. After the 6th of June, absent any change in the statute, there may be a different experience.
Okay. That's what I thought. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions for Mr. Duffy or Deputy Commissioner Dole? Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So somebody wants to come on base with their children and they do have a passport, how are the children handled?
So through the chair, Representative Tuck, in the normal process, DOD ID cards are issued for those children ages 10 and older. It was my experience when in command, and that may have changed since I left, that we would look to validate credentials for children, non-DOD children, in the age of 16 and older. So there was about a 16-year-old threshold, for, I'll call it for a civilian child, if you will, to use a simpler term.
Follow up?
Yeah, so let me just repeat through the chair, is that if a child is 10 years or older, but younger than 16, that they would be, I didn't quite follow that, because we had a 10 and older than we had 16. So if somebody wanted to take your two children on base and they are compliant, what are the requirements for their children to be able to go on base with them?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tuck, let me clarify. So for a DOD dependent, for my two boys, who were sons of an Air Force guy, they got an ID card issued from the DOD at age 10, so age 10 and up. For my brother, whose two boys are not DOD kids, they're just kids, civilian kids living on the north side of Atlanta, if he wanted to visit me on base, they would stop at the visitor's control center. They would present some form of ID. If his oldest son was 16 and older, we'd look for a form of ID for him. If his youngest son was 15 and under, we'd probably let it go. And I can validate with JBRA officials again to follow the line from before through the chair.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So just make sure I clarify through the chair. So if it's a military dependent, then that child will automatically get an ID card at age of 10. And do they have to show ID to, or what do they need to show to get their ID at 10, or is it automatic? It made it sound like it was automatic. Do they have to show a birth certificate or something?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, the way that works is they're entered into what's called the DEAR systems, the defense, and I apologize, it's in essence the database that has the military members and their families' details, if you will. And so that birth certificate is required shortly after birth to register that child in this dependent eligible system. It's what allows you then to draw with dependent entitlements. So if you're a dad with two kids and a wife, you know, all of those have to be entered, all those details have to be entered into the defense, I think it's eligibility entitlement registration system or something to that effect. I apologize, I don't have the acronym right. But that in essence turns on their DOD sponsorship, if you will.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, follow up.
And so then if a civilian goes on to base and has two children, and well, has a child to go with them, if they're 16 and older, they may have to show ID. However, if that 16-year-old or 17-year-old has a younger brother or sister, then they may not need the requirement.
That was the threshold when I was in command, and I'll be glad to go back and talk with the team to see if that's still the case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Duffy or Deputy Commissioner Toll? Thank you, Mr. Duffy, for making yourself available. And that takes us to the last person under invited testimony, or really entity. It's Anchorage School District, and there are several online. It looks like Susan Schmidt, Senior Director for Staffing and Operations, Janet Hayes, Executive Assistant to the Superintendent, Mike Fleckstein, the Chief Information Officer, but it looks like Tom Roth, the Chief Operations Officer for ASD, is here to testify. Mr. Roth, if I have that right, could you put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and present your perspective on House Bill 74.
Thank you, through the chair. Good afternoon. My name is Tom Roth, and I am the Chief Operating Officer of the Anchorage School District. I am calling in reference to House Bill 74, and on behalf of Dr. Bishop, I endorse the passage of this bill. My purpose this afternoon is to provide information and analysis concerning the impact of federal implementation of Phase 3 of the Real ID Act of 2005 on the Anchorage School District. I want to first provide some context. The Anchorage School District provides an education to 1,597 students at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, the majority of whom are dependents of active duty Army soldiers and Air Force airmen, at five elementary schools located on the installation. The district's information technology department, which is inclusive of the district's data infrastructure in its entirety, is also located on JBEAR in the Kennedy IT Center. JBEAR is also home to the district's Fine Arts Department. From J-Bear, the district's pupil transportation department buses 26 special needs students to schools throughout the district and 513 secondary school students to middle and high schools in Eagle River and Anchorage. At any given time during the standard school day, up to 500 ASD employees support J-Bear activities, schools, and students. The district's mission on J-Bear is holistic and comprehensive. Although the five elementary schools and Kennedy IT Center reside on a federal installation, Anchorage School District employees provide education to all students, provide administrative oversight to school staffs, maintain, repair, and clean all ASD facilities and equipment, perform or manage construction projects, manage and maintain networks, and generally perform all functions expected of a neighborhood elementary school. Simply put, our mission on J-Bear, educating all students for success in life, is an imperative, and it requires access for all ASD employees, to include those who substitute teach or work part-time. ASD's time to act is now. To sustain our J-Bear mission, the district will mandate employees, both current and new, without a real ID compliant identification, to obtain the same at individual cost beginning in early April. We assess this action is necessary, and the timing should allow sufficient processing time for employees to receive a compliant identification before the 6 June implementation date. In closing, I respectfully request timely legislative action to enact House Bill 74. As the chair mentioned, I'm joined this afternoon by senior ASD staff, and my colleagues and I are prepared to receive any questions or comments from the committee. Thank you for your time and for your consideration.
Questions for Mr. Roth or Anchorage School District Representative Knopp?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Roth, so you mentioned five elementary schools and I think an IT school or something, is that correct? So, and 1,000-plus kids in there. Are they all military kids? Do they live on base?
Through the chair to Representative Tuck. I don't have the precise numbers in front of me, but I do believe of that 1,597 students I quoted, there is just in the neighborhood of 100 students that are actually dependents of civilian personnel who are allowed to reside in J-Bear housing.
Representative Knopp, a follow-up.
So elementary school, is that like kindergarten through 6th grade, 8th grade? Where are we at on elementary school? So I guess where I'm going with that, and age, so kids 10 and older are going to be required to have the biometric cards or real ID of some type? Or how is that going to work?
Through the chair, I think Mr. Duffy did discuss in some detail the dependents of military personnel do not require any identification until age 10, at which point it's really incumbent on the parents to take them down and get them an ID card, and as Mr. Duffy explained, by that point, those individuals, those students would already be enrolled in the DEERS program. So the DBIDS, in my experience in my time in the military, really is more for the adult 16 and above in order to gain access onto the installation. Kids who would be in the elementary schools would not have that requirement.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions for Anchorage School District, Representative Ledoux?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank Mr. Roth and the school district for being proactive to have made arrangements so that just in case the state doesn't pass this legislation, that there is a way for Anchorage School District employees to get on base.
Further questions or comments for Mr. Roth or Anchorage School District, Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now that we're talking about children coming on and off base on buses, is it only required that the driver have a real ID card, or do students older than 10, if they're military family people and they have a kind of card, is that a debit card, or any child over 16, is there any complications getting on and off base currently, and will there be complications?
And Mr. Roth, feel free to take a whack at that. I also see Mr. Duffy may have perspective on that question as well.
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Duffy. Currently, it is only the bus drivers that are obligated to present their identification in order to access the base. There is not a requirement even for high school students who are coming back from school to have identification checked. Now, what I don't know, once this phase three is implemented on 6 June, whether or not that will change, I'm not aware of that requirement. So I will defer to Mr. Duffy if he has more current information than me.
And Mr. Duffy's shaking his head. Thank you, Mr. Roth, for that answer. Follow-up question, Representative Tuck?
No, but I missed which direction his head was shaking. I'm sorry. Could you shake your head again?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, nothing else to add. Thank you.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Any further questions for Anchorage School District or Mr. Roth? And I'm not sure the DOA Deputy Commissioner has been able to join us, but if there are any questions for DMV Director Thompson or Ms. Montalbo about the bill as a whole or any other questions, now might be the time. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know that we have on our books right now that the Department Administration shall not spend any money towards the Real ID Act. But did we recently go into an agreement to a state and state verification system right now with AAMVA? Have we gone into that agreement?
Director Thompson?
Through the chair, could I have you repeat that question?
Yes, through the chair, this is Representative Tuck. So the have we gone into any agreements right now with AAMVA, their state-to-state verification service? Have we, the state of Alaska, are we in contract with them currently?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Tuck, AAMVA is an organization of all the states and provinces that have driver's licenses. And it really is the best practices. They're the ones who work with the different state agencies and different databases that are out there. And they help the state connect to them and provide the access instead of each state having to go and have that discussion with the U.S. Passport or Homeland Security. So they really are just helping. It's a nonprofit. It's not a best practice. They don't commit us to using Real ID. We use it for a lot of the different databases. I think you might remember the PowerPoint that we went through with the list of databases.
Follow-up, Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we are exchanging information through AAMVA currently. Are we able to get information from other states as well?
So we don't, through the chair, we don't actually connect with AAMVA directly on most of them. We use SALT, which is the Social Security. We're actually going and verifying the Social Security number with the Social Security Administration. AAMVA just created an easier way for the state to make that connection. We can query, but we can query to verify, but we don't share the data. I guess that's the easiest way to
follow up.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So you're having difficulties going through the Social Security Administration directly, so you've signed onto a contract with this organization to get that access. Am I hearing that correctly?
It's not real. So through the chair, Representative Tuck, it's not a commitment or a contract with AAMVA per se. We actually work with the Social Security Administration
AMBA has helped all of the states get together and use that same process.
So if I may...
Yes, we do verify. We have SOLVE, which is with the Social Security Administration. We do the Problems with Driver Pointers System, which is through the U.S. Department of Transportation. We do state-to-state, which is it is state-to-state. We would, let's say you had a Montana driver's license, we would query Montana to see if you have that driver's license and let them know that you now have an Alaska driver's license because you're only allowed to have one. So those are a few of the ones we do today.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So if I heard you correctly, then you did not sign a contract with them. It wasn't required. You guys just used your services somehow.
Yes, we do use those services.
Okay, no contract required, no monies, no payments required through the chair?
There are payments, and it's based on usage. But I will have to check on the contract.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions for the DMV from the committee? Seeing none, we'll hold this bill. And I think at some point in the future there will be public testimony. See how this week shakes out with the operating budget. But that's it for today's hearing. A note on the agenda, SB 46 and HB 94, African American soldiers who built Alaska Highway Day. That will be held at least until next week and not be heard this week. There may be other changes to the schedule as well. We also weren't hearing House Bill 112 today, but we'll keep members updated by email. But that concludes our business. On a personal note, would like to wish Kelsey Goodell well. She's been in the back of the room many of the weeks so far this legislative session and hope she recovers in Seattle. But thank you, Ben, for standing in. And thanks, Stephanie and Martha. And at 4:41 p.m., we're adjourned.